everyone, and welcome back to Straight Up, your must-listen pod for all things music and culture, where my fellow journalist Ellie Halls and I interview the most influential movers and shakers in the music industry over a nice strong drink to get all the juicy insight that you never normally hear.
So this episode's guest is pretty major. It is Stuart Camp, none other than the long-term manager of the world's most successful male recording artist, Ed Sheeran. He's been Ed's right-hand man ever since Ed got dropped by his previous management for not dyeing his hair black. You can hear that insane story in more detail during our chat. And they're so close, Ed calls Stuart and his partner mum and dad, and even lived with them for several years.
We both literally could not stop laughing during this conversation, which we recorded earlier this summer, just before Ed announced the birth of his baby. Stuart is really, really hilarious, and he shares so many fantastic stories about Ed, from the very strange clause that he insists they keep in their management contract, to the weird staple item on Ed's rider, and what really happened when he got stuck in a field of snakes at Russell Crowe's house in Australia. And yes, you did hear that correct.
You can see why they're such good friends, and fun fact, even own a pub together in London. My favourite story was about Ed moving into the house literally across the road from Stuart because he couldn't bear to be apart from him. And the story is also about Kevin, Ed's most loyal security guard, are amazing.
Yep, we are now obsessed with Kevin, and you are definitely going to be as well. Stuart also talks about the secrets to his world-dominating success, as well as the most challenging parts of being a manager and how he got his first job, all the way through to the emotional toll of looking after such a famous global star whom everyone wants a piece of.
We loved talking to Stuart, who, despite his management company being called Grumpy Old Management, seems to be one of the cheeriest and nicest people we've ever met. And when you listen to this episode, it'll be pretty easy to see why he is one of the most successful managers of all time, no less.
100%. Final point, thank you as always to Marlon Percy for our music and editing. His incredible new single Shame is out now on all streaming platforms, so do go check that out. And if you have any questions or suggestions, as ever, please email hello@straightuppodcast.co.uk, or you can find us each on Instagram at elliehalls1 or kathleen.m.johnston.
Enjoy the episode, bye! Stuart, thank you so much for coming on as a guest of Straight Up. We wanted to start with a very funny anecdote that we came up against when we were looking into you.
Yeah.
And it was that Ed always inserts a stupid clause into your contract every year when it renews.
Yes, he does.
Can you tell us a little bit more about why and what these clauses are?
First of all, when I first met Ed, I worked for Rocket Music, which is Elton John's company. So it was all a different scenario. And then 2014, I started managing him directly. So I think we were in Japan or Korea. We were in a Chinese restaurant and he was very drunk and being really, really obnoxious. So I refused to sit next to him. I was like, I'm not sitting next to you, you're being an asshole. And I think it was just at the time we were negotiating the contract and moving out of Rocket. And he instantly rang his lawyer at the time, said, you need to put a clause in Stuart's contract that he has to sit next to me at all times. And that's where that started. And it's like, I had to sit next to him, but I also had to look like I was enjoying myself. So this caused so much issues with Rocket, because we were sort of had a joint venture with Rocket as we left. And then I think it actually put 2 months and about 10 grand onto my lawyer's bill, because everyone was panicking, because they were like, hang on, Rocket were like, but what if this is a ruse and they're just going to say that Stuart's in breach of his photograph looking grumpy sitting next to Ed. So it all curtailed from that, and it was just rather silly. But now it's changed. Now, what is it now? I haven't got my wallet with me. I have to have a picture of the two twins from Harry Potter with me at all times.
Front door. Yeah.
And I've actually, he's built, we have an office, which is Ed's old house in Notting Hill. And he's built a contraption so that behind my desk, you can press a button and the fuckers appear slowly. They rise up from behind my desk.
Oh my God, that's so good.
So there's that. And there's also on his birthday, I have to have a Colin the Caterpillar birthday cake for him wherever he goes.
How many times have you breached your contract, do you think?
Not once. Not once.
You actually...
Not once. Every press photo I've done, I think I have to have a picture of them in my wallet. And yeah, I don't think there's actually ever been a breach. Every time he's tried to catch me out,
You've had it?
Yes.
So is that where the name Grumpy Old Management comes from?
That sort of came from that, because when the negotiations were happening for me and Ed going separate from Rocket, it was all a bit cloak and dagger and what have you. And the working title was just between Ed and the lawyer, who I wasn't meant to be speaking to at the time, was just call it Grumpy Management for a laugh. And then it just, when the time came for it actually to be made real, well, I'll bugger it, just stick with it.
Because you are very, you're not grumpy at all.
Oh, I can be, allegedly. I'm probably actually the happiest member of our staff. But I think it, the main thing that stuck it for me was that they let me, and I'm never allowed to use it on because I wanted to make business cards. Our general information email is goaway@iamgrumpy.com, which which does work if you try it. But the girls in the office, they've banned me from ever giving it to anybody in case it gives the wrong impression. But that's what clinched it.
You met Ed when you were, as you say, working at Rocket, and he was supporting, he came on a came on board as a support act for Just Jack. But it took a little while for you guys to solidify a professional relationship between the two.
Yeah, it took, that would have been, God, that must have been 2009, 2010, must have been 2009. And then he was actually managed by someone else at the time. And Jack had rung me and he's going, he said, fuck coming to see me. You have to get up early and see this kid who's supporting me. He's out of this world. And I was like, yeah, but he's managed by someone else. Don't worry. And he goes, yeah, that ain't going to last. So we went anyway. And was just blown away. And then that's, yeah, that would have been late-ish 2009. So it was at least another year or so before it became official that I became his manager. His, the other management actually resigned from him because they said he wasn't going anywhere. He had to drop the looping and dye his hair black.
They must be kicking.
Dye his hair black.
Oh, yeah, dye his hair black and give up the loop pedal and give up the rapping, which I can see, but I kind of see a point there. But,
I watched his Nando's rap the other day.
Oh, God, we're never allowed to mention that. He gets really funny about it. But I think that was actually one of the first things where it went public with him and Example. That was the first time. That was the first time that friends of mine that weren't necessarily in the industry. So people were sending to me saying, have you seen this lad? I was like, for fuck's sake, I've been talking about him for a year. And you're now sending it to me just because he's singing with Example in the, wherever it was. It's the car park in Norwich waterfront. And yeah, that was actually quite a turning point, but you can't talk about it now. The sense of humour goes out the window.
So has the old management company kind of come crawling back at any point?
Not crawling back. I think for a while, they don't exist in the same form anymore. They splintered about 4 years ago. But I think for a long time, their website said they discovered Ed Sheeran, which was a course of sort of hilarity. Like, you didn't mention the bit that you said he was shit and he went away.
Yeah.
So no, but you know. I speak to the manager in question a few times. It's fine. It's one of those things. Everyone's got acts that, you know, it doesn't happen or runs away. I'm sure I've got some somewhere.
Ed's moved in with you as soon as you became
pretty much that day or the day bloody after. I think we'd gone, when it sort of became official, we went to the pub for the day or we went to the pub for lunch. And then before we knew it, it was like 6 o'clock. And luckily it was only two doors down from Rocket. So we probably crawled on our hands and knees back to the Rocket office. I think he went home to stay with his girlfriend for one night and then turned up my doorstep like the next day and then never left. Ever left. We moved house 3 times. I moved to a house with only one bedroom. He still managed to come. There's kind of an avoidance scheme. So yeah, he must have lived with me at least 2 years.
Why? Just because he had like nowhere else to
stay? He had nowhere to stay and he'd been so used to just sofa surfing. And he had a house in Suffolk, but yeah, he just didn't. Eventually, we sort of talked him into buying a flat and he bought the flat. He bought the flat opposite me first.
Opposite.
Oh my gosh.
And then my girlfriend was getting all paranoid saying, do we need to feed him? I'm like, no, it's fine. It's the first night he'd moved over the road. And not making up, we opened the curtains of our flat and looked over the road and he was just standing at his window staring at us.
like some spectre.
So he never went far. And then we moved again and he bought the fucking flat upstairs. That was in Balham, yeah.
Is he just very needy?
Say again, is he needy?
Is he just quite a needy person,
He's quite clingy, in a good way. But
it sounds quite sweet.
He is very sweet. And for the first few years, he still is to a certain degree. He's almost my surrogate son as well as someone I manage.
Because he calls you dad.
Is it true he calls your partner mum?
Yeah, she gets really upset if he doesn't call her mum. And then his real mum gets upset about it, as you would. But yes, we're definitely parents point two. Definitely.
Because you've spoken a lot before about guardianship being quite an important, an integral part of management. Do you feel super nervous then when you're thinking about Ed's well-being beyond like work? So when you hear stories when he hurt himself when he was travelling or...
At the end of the day, ultimately, it's all the same thing. My job is just to keep him alive, really, at the end of the day. And everything else kind of comes with it. There's been times where he broke both his wrists about...
Oh my God.
That was a good phone call to get. It was like towards because we did a 3-year tour on the last album. So I think it was towards the end of the first year. And we had a week off between North America and going to Asia. And the North American tour was an arena tour. We'd had like 6 shows on, 1 day off for about 2 months. We were all knackered. Everyone hated each other at this point. And Ed had gone cycling. And I got a phone. We got a phone call at 6 o'clock on a Sunday morning from his now wife going, can you put me on the insurance for Ed's car? I'm like, why? She goes, oh, don't worry. I'm just driving him to the hospital. You know, what the fuck's going on? So he'd come off his, he'd raced a bike and he'd hit the wrong brakes and he'd gone over and landed on both his things. But luckily, it was this wrist and that elbow. If it had been the other way around, we'd have been out of action for 6 months. You couldn't play the guitar. But as it was the right combination of elbow and wrist that he broke. But the irony is that everyone was so relieved. We're like, oh, you mean we can actually have about 3 weeks off without having to go to Asia? Which is sad. And we did make up those shows in the end. But just things like that, when you get those calls, you do panic and there is that whole thing. And your first instinct is always just, yeah, make sure the little sod doesn't do something stupid because he is clumsy.
Did you see a picture of his burning foot?
I've always been relatively dubious about that one. He's like, he put his foot in a geyser and apparently melted the boot off his foot. Exactly. And it's all, oh, I was airlifted out and all this sort of stuff. And I'm not sure about that one. there might have been some embellishments to that story. But that was when he was having a proper year off. So that was Kevin, our security, has the pleasure of following him around and keeping him alive for those times. But
so his security must actually get quite a nice holiday whenever Ed decides to go on.
Well, I don't know if you speak to Kevin, he probably thinks it's the worst torture in hell. But he does. Kevin's seen more of the world than anybody because he just has to trail him and the wife everywhere they go.
Do you get postcards?
Or you get postcards. You usually get grumpy phone calls going, there's no McDonald's in Manila or wherever it is there all the time. But there was the Magical Mystery Tour. They went away for like 8 months.
What's your workload like when Ed's not working? So like when he took a year off, are you like still filing on all cylinders?
Well, to be fair, that year off when he was travelling, I just ended up being his travel agent for a lot of the time because they literally just sort of said, fuck it, we're going to have 6 months off, and they didn't really know where they were going. So it was like, oh, we're going to go here next week or there next week. So that was relatively busy. And also, because I tour with Ed when we do the touring, as soon as I'm home, everyone kind of knows where I am and you're just catching up on meetings and things like that.
I was going to say, do you have like several people on your team or is it literally just you and Ed?
It's principally just me and Ed. There's about 3 people who work in the grumpy office and that's it.
You only manage Ed, whereas obviously some managers have multiple acts on at one go. Why is that important for you?
I don't think I'd have the time, frankly, because it is 24/7 with Ed, because I look after all the personal life, all the investments, all the businesses that aren't necessarily the Ed Sheeran, you know, what have you. So I overlook that. And also, I think any other act, if I was managing directly, they'd always know or always feel they'd be second best to him if there was an issue, which I don't think I'd take if I was being managed by someone. And I just think, yeah, I've been very, obviously, very fortunate enough, there's no need. You know, it's like, it does take up my entire life, but thankfully we're doing well enough that I don't have to worry about managing someone else.
What do you think you learned from managing James Blunt and Lily Allen?
Well, I was the day-to-day manager. I wasn't the main manager, so be careful on that.
Okay.
Todd Interlab was the main manager, but I was the one that did all the travelling and all the responsibility, none of the powers when you're a day-to-day manager rather than the direct manager. But that was very, with James, it was the work ethic. And ironically, I was still looking after James when I first met Ed. And Ed would come, well, Ed would obviously come to my house. He was sleeping in it. He'd go through my bags and find James's schedules and things like that and go, I want to work harder than this.
I heard about this 2006 diary.
Yeah. He'd just pull out the diaries and go, I want to do more than this. I'm like, but every fucking day is full. How can you do more? And that was always his drive, that he wanted to work that hard. And we did. So that was a big thing with James. James was always, I mean, James is amazing. Obviously, being ex-military, he was the one getting us out of bed and organising everyone else. But just in terms of going everywhere and getting stuff done, that was amazing.
And what was Lily like? I read a quote where you said, like, yeah, amazing on a great day.
Don't bring this up again because people reprint it. It was lovely sometimes and not lovely sometimes. That's, you know, it's just, you know, it's I think it was hard of her that she didn't enjoy the travelling and the touring and the promotion as much as some people. So it's,
did you ever have to get a flight, an emergency flight home to just
away
decompress?
Oh yeah.
Just take yourself out of
the situation. Invent some other crisis. You know, it's like, oh, my relative that doesn't really exist has just died of God.
Well, that's the problem with only managing one person at a time, is you never have an excuse. You never have like a...
Oh, no, exactly. No, I don't have any excuse with Edward. He's, it's remarkable, actually, because we talk every day. Now he's discovered video conferencing in lockdown. I don't know why it's taken him that to figure out he can do it, but you can't get rid of him now. This is just like, he's constantly popping.
But he's still on a break, right?
Well, he started recording now. But for him, that is a break. He's not doing anything public this year at all.
I've heard he's taken up painting.
He's quite good. It's an absolute...
He's changed the work for a while.
Yeah, it's a Pollock ripoff completely. But it's actually not... They're not bad. They're really not bad.
He sent you one, right?
Yeah, there's one. I think it's still wrapped up. It's fucking massive. I don't know how big he thinks my house is. It's not as big as his. Because it's about taller than that wall.
It looks like you've got a space ready for it.
Yeah. No, well, actually, I don't think... No, it wouldn't fit. It's taller.
Oh, it's bigger than that.
Yeah, it's huge. It's absolutely huge.
What's it of?
It's like Jackson Pollock. So it's just loads of splashes. But it's not as random and as shit as that sounds. It's actually... Annoyingly, he's quite good at it. Because he's one of those people who's very good at things, apart from driving. And but he's, it's all right. It's all right. So that's his, you know, he's doing that. They're gardening. There's, you know, he's making a nice little...
And you've got your little pub together as well?
Yes, we have a little pub that is obviously not open at all at the moment.
But you haven't furloughed your workers, unlike...
No, Steve we just thought that would just be a bit rude. And then given, yeah... As a standalone business, and that's the worst business decision we've ever made, but we just thought it was the right thing to do on the grander scale. So, but you know,
do people know it's Ed Sheeran's pub when they go in? It's in Notting Hill, isn't it?
It's in, yes, but no, they don't. There's nothing Ed related in it at all. He was, when we first got it, he was like, I can put some discs and a guitar up in it. I was like, we're not doing the shit Hard Rock Cafe at all. So, so it isn't. So, I mean, people do know, and we have, it's quite weird. The odd occasion we've been in there, the two of us, we usually will go for lunch around the corner and we'll end up in there half cut, and you'll see someone. I think we met some girl who'd come from Canada for her 21st with her mum, and she didn't know she was going to meet Ed. She was just an Ed fan, and so she wanted a pint in his restaurant. We bowled in completely several sheets to the wind, and it just made her day. So it's funny. So things like that happen that are quite sweet. But it's certainly not a pop star's pub. You wouldn't think of it as such.
Because so you mentioned as well that Ed's working on the new album. I know he is quite like, he has been quite militaristic in his planning. Lots of the albums, you know, marked out for the certain year stretch. How much do you guys forward plan? Like, is everything planned out for the next 5 years? Do you know what releases are coming when? Or is it a little bit...
Ed will tell you everything's planned, and he's got the... I'm actually looking at a piece of paper here, which I can't show you, that actually has the track listing for the album after the next one written on it. Which is just in his head, he thinks it's done and it's fine. And that's definitely the track listing. I've crossed out most of the names on it. But in his, that's it for him. Well, I don't know if that's a writing thing for him, whether he thinks one day he's just going to wake up and it's all going to have gone and he won't be able to do it anymore. Because he's always one or two albums ahead. So we know pretty much what we're doing until about 2024, but of course everything's slightly up in the air now. But all being well, I mean, we're lucky. We hadn't planned any shows for next year anyway.
Great.
Of course, this year is out. So, you know, the situation will right itself. But we know, we've got a tour rooted up to 24. But whether he can do it or not.
Because you've got, I guess, like you said, Ed's bread and butter, really, whilst he does stadiums, which are outside shows. He is, like, so well-respected for his live show. That's, like... his thing. Have you guys thought about alternative?
Well, we will do. We'll have to at some point. But it's, you're right, because that's kind of been our whole thing. The whole career has been built on the shows. You know,
he broke the record. He's the most successful touring artist of all time.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
600 million, I think, Divide got.
So he's yeah, in his head, probably part of him thinks it'd be great if no one can tour again. So that record will always be mine. So that's the only blessing that will come out of it for his mind. But no, it's weird because it's our whole sort of modus operandi will change. So who knows? Who knows?
Can you imagine him doing a Zoom gig?
No. He's really... I think we probably...
Just no.
No.
I'm sick of him.
For someone of his age, you're this generation that's meant to be technically savvy, he's not at all.
Oh, he'd probably leave the meeting after he'd...
Oh, absolutely. He wouldn't. He'd bugger it up. But who knows? There'll be... maybe. Maybe. We've got to figure out a way to do something like that and make it interesting. Even in the best world of the world, we're not travelling anywhere probably next year even, so who knows.
You mentioned the music itself being planned. So when you're looking at the track list you've got, have you heard the songs? Are they songs you've worked on for a while?
No. Yeah, we've heard the songs. What you do, I've got about 50 songs that you just literally have a loop on the computer, just playing over and over and over again. The way I work it is that if one's boring me or I don't like it, you just delete it. And then you just go down to, you've got, and then you send it to him and he gets really upset because all the songs that it's always inevitably the ones that are the most personal to him and mean the most, that I go straight in and go, that's shit.
But then on the flip side, right, wasn't Shape of You actually written for Rihanna and it took you and was it Ben Cook having to be like, are you insane, put that on your album?
Yeah, we were, I forgot what studio, right? We were in a studio in North London and we were waiting for a drummer to turn up for a session. And Ed was like, oh, I did these the other day, but I'm not going to keep them. And he played Shape of You. And we're like, fucking idiot. What do you mean? Because me, Ben Cook, and Ed Howard just looking at each other going, what do you mean you're not keeping this? But then Sing on the previous album was exactly the same. He just played it by accident one day. And we're like, this is absolute nonsense. So things happen by accident.
How did he decide to get Stormzy on that song?
On Take You Back to London.
Yeah, and Shape of You with the remix.
Oh, the Shape of the remix. That was. They were friends. They'd met. Ed wanted to sign Stormzy to Gingerbread, but at the time, that was when Atlantic was still courting him. So they were friends anyway, and it was just, we just wanted to do something different, and that it just worked out really bloody well. And they're really good friends. They get on like house on fire. Those two, they're very close.
Yeah, I've seen them in interviews together.
Yeah, like, it's a proper little bromance.
Oh, it's the noisy one that they do together.
Yeah. No, they.
Well, both of them, interestingly, both of them have had this kind of big exit from social media.
Yeah.
Which I think is actually really great in kind of rerouting what our concept of celebrity is. You know, I used to think that if someone was a celebrity is off social media, they're either like depressed, not working, or like literally don't exist. When actually, loads of our friends that have social media, our parents don't. Like, we don't think that of them. And I wonder if maybe this will start like a new way of kind of
people
seeing celebrity.
Yeah, you'd hope so. I mean, it's the sort of, the record label had an absolute fit when we said he was coming off Twitter. And but I know for his actual well-being, his own health, the difference was so marked as soon as he stopped. Because he can't resist looking up, Googling himself anyway. And he always does it. And that will never change.
Does he?
Yeah, he's obsessed. But he would just always go, he'd always just go for the negative comments. And he'd find them on Twitter and Twitter was a poisonous place at the best of times. So, and it was just like, just ignore it.
So do you think he might not come back?
He definitely won't ever be back on Twitter. Definitely not.
Interesting.
Never. He hasn't been on Twitter since about 2014, I think, 15.
Does it affect sales or kind of presence in any way?
It can do. There's certain territories, and don't ask me to name them because that's why I've smarter people in my office, but there's certain territories that do and don't have Twitter, and that's how you get the reach. And ditto Facebook. There's like, Facebook means nothing in lots of parts of Asia and what have you. So there's different platforms reach different areas. So it's certainly, and I think he had like 30 million odd followers. So you think about that as in terms of people you're connected with, there's certainly that stream, that avenue's gone. Then yeah, it's not the most sensible business decision to make if you want to communicate with people.
Was there ever a thought that he might have accounts, but that he wouldn't use them personally? Or was it like, no, if I'm going to come off, I'm coming off completely?
Yeah, he's coming off completely. He never wanted to be someone who had the fake person pretending to be him or any of that.
Because so many politicians have secret Instagram accounts.
Really?
Yeah, because I saw a great article, I can't remember where it was, on Slate or something, of someone that basically it was their business to like unearth, like Mitt Romney's secret Instagram or whatever. And they all have them.
Yeah. I came off Twitter a year ago, I must have known how long it was. But yeah, it's been better for it. It's just not.
Also in terms of security, it must help, right? Because I was thinking like how you see all these, I can't remember which footballer it was recently that was robbed after he posted.
Yeah, it was Dele Alli.
Dele Alli, yeah. And obviously Kim Kardashian's had that. And, you know, Stormzy has trained these two bulldogs specifically for his security. I read the other day on the Daily Mail that Ed Sheeran's house has something like 47,000 searches a year, which is like one of the top.
I saw that. I think it's mainly because people are just gobsmacked that it looks like a gypsy caravan park. but the Daily Mail always print this same god-awful Some bastard flew a drone over it about 2 years ago when it was a building site, and they keep printing the same picture. The only thing they do, he's got this like man-made lake that they're hounding him, saying he's using it as a private swimming pool and he doesn't have permission, which he does. So there's this awful, you could Google it, there's this awful picture, and they keep painting in this bloody lake bright blue to look like a normal swimming pool. But it looks like such a, Google it after this, looks like such a dump. But it's nice now, it's been finished, but yeah, it was just a building site in the middle of nowhere in Suffolk.
Do you worry about Ed's safety when it comes to like stalkers and stuff like
that? Oh, 100%, because that's the thing you argue with, because everyone's like, oh, it's all about right to know, as you know, as you're a journalist. But at the same time, you start printing pictures, particularly the London, he had the house in London, which is now my office. Our friends at The Sun were just printing that picture every other week, and they were like, but this isn't fair, because people, he had no front garden. There was literally a door that opened onto the street. And we were just like, well, this is ridiculous. So he moved, purely on a safety situation, because everyone knew it was his house. So there is elements of that, and you have to be sensible.
Has your safety ever been compromised?
Not really, no. You get been threatened by a few people, but nothing in a serious level at all. And
what's the worst mad fan? Like, are there kind of stalkers?
There are a few. We get sent lots of pictures you really don't want to see. And I thought that, yeah, it was just nasty stuff. But bless him, his mum gets most of the actual physical post, because she used to run a jewellery store wing of his website for years. And I think she's stopped now. But there was an address.
Oh, her jewellery business was all in the...
it was in the press.
Last week, literally.
It's all gone tits up, apparently. But no, she's just taking a break because she can't post anything better. So it's a little cottage industry that she did quite well out of. But I think everyone got her address. So she used to get lots of really strange things. And I just get quite a lot of like people that are obviously slightly mentally troubled. A lot of that. But yeah, you're always going to get that. There's some lad in Asia who keeps emailing me and Pharrell saying we owe him money every day. You wake up to a new email, and they're about 3 pages long. You're like, he must just sit up doing nothing but sending us these emails. But every day I get one. So it's things like that. It's just...
But no one's infiltrated like a hotel room or...
Oh, we've had that before. Not hotel rooms. We've had people that have got on floors and banged on doors before and all things like that. But you know... Luckily, the bigger the touring part of the infrastructure gets, we take over entire floors and you have security on the door and the lifts and things like that. So it's not too bad. I think they've found the odd weirdo outside his house in Suffolk. But yeah, touch wood, we've been very lucky. We've had nothing that I'd consider dangerous anyway.
That's good.
Yeah, just people overzealous and quite keen, but nothing. I don't think there's been anything where we think, well, actually, that's not safe.
And does he generally, other than the one security guard that kind of travels around the world with, does he have like a big security detail? That
no, not at all. He has, on tour, we have 3 security. So there's Kevin, and then there's 2 other boys that do all the sort of the venue security as well.
And is one of them like incognito?
Well, they always try and look incognito. All security guards look the same, don't they?
They all
look
like, but they're all huge.
They're all absolutely massive. People usually think I'm the bloody bouncer as well. Yeah, so no, not really incognito, but you never wanted to be that person surrounded by people pushing people out of the way. We'd never be that. That would just be horrific. Yeah. So Kevin's more of a visual deterrent, who's just good at swearing at people when because Ed's far too polite. Ed will stop and do anything for anybody. Kevin's job is just to come in and go, fuck off, and drag him away. And that works well. So yeah, touch wood, we've been very lucky.
And now for a very short break to say thank you very much once again to our series sponsor, Master of Malt, the incredible online drinks and spirits retailer that basically saved our souls through lockdown.
Yep, so Master of Malt sell everything from wine to whiskey, but for this episode, we got to try one of our all-time favourite spirits, tequila.
We are obsessed with margaritas, and this tequila, Fortaleza Blanco, makes an insanely good one, which we put to the test while recording, obviously. That said, it's so pure and smooth that really it's wasted in a cocktail and actually tastes bang served ice.
It does, and Ellie, is your favourite drink for a night out not a tequila soda? I think you've raved about it on the podcast before.
I know, as fans of the pod will know, I said this to Fraser, T. Smith, who actually agreed with me.
Because you just don't get a hangover.
I don't get hangovers, and my favourite is a chili margarita.
Oh, like a picante.
The Soho House Picante.
Yum.
Is what we lived on this weekend, isn't it?
Oh my God, yeah, so good. But you know they actually like make them on tap now because there's just too many that get ordered.
Too many orders.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, I would never have known though. So good.
I know, it's still nice and strong. But anyway, guys, you can buy the Fortaleza Blanco tequila for $64.75 at masterofmalt.com straight up. That's our special landing page, which hopefully you all know by now. So masterofmalt.com/straight up.
Please drink responsibly and enjoy.
So for you as a manager, what does your actual day-to-day look like? Because obviously, you know, the manager is a well-known trope, be it in recent biopics or just generally in pop culture. But I think people, there's not much clarity about what it is that you actually do, like you say, beyond organising someone's schedule.
I think my father asked me that about 2 weeks ago. He said, what do you actually do? I was like, you've been milking this for years. And now you've actually said, what actually is it? And it's kind of hard to describe because it really is. It's a cliche, but it's different every day. At the moment, I'm getting up every day. We're sorting out studio. We sort, you know, you answer emails non-stop. I mean, I pretty much look after every aspect of his life. So if you can imagine what's going on, it's from, you know, sorting out the imaginary chickens at his house and all the other houses. So it's there is no normal days. At the moment, I'm trying to keep a schedule where I'm in my office at 8:30 and hopefully finished by 2 in terms of answering emails or just have my mobile with me. Because otherwise, I'll just go mad. And but there is no normal day. On tour, it's obviously, you know, it's a bit more of a routine because you're into wherever you're traveling to. But otherwise, it's not really a job you can put the job description down as. It's pretty much you get the blame for everything and the thanks for nothing. But that's just part of it.
What would you say is the most challenging part of your job?
Not going. There is an insane amount of pressure. Where it's relentless. There is no break for me. I think that's probably there is no break ever. Rarely. Genuinely, the last thing before I go to sleep and the first thing in the morning is about him. And I wouldn't change it for anything at all. But it's not something you can never switch off in any capacity. It's probably the one thing. It's very rare.
What's the longest break you've had, do you think?
What, from him? I've not been on holiday. The last holiday I had was when the Two Towers happened. So that was in 2000. Wow. That was the last time I went on holiday. So not that I think it was some bad omen and it was my fault, but that was the last holiday I've had. I just haven't, I don't do it. I know I do the occasional sort of, I'll have a staycation. I say, I'm turning my phone off for 3 days. And I last about 5 minutes. It doesn't really work. So no, I don't ever. I know I had a holiday. I went to the Antarctica in December for 3 weeks, but with him. So that was a holiday, but it was still with Ed. So doesn't quite count.
One of my favourite things that I heard you say, I think it was on a podcast, it was like a tip for younger people like making their way in the industry. And you said, rather than like, you know, going back and screaming and shouting or having a go at people, like one of the best things that you can do is just give someone the silent treatment.
Oh yeah.
And you found that to be quite a powerful tool. I love that. Could you like tell us a little bit more about how you make that work? Because I want
to. It's quite simple, but you just have to be in a situation where you can get away with it. And then, but then I think it's because, going back to that earlier answer about how we're quite inclusive, we're not the old managers, we don't see the record label as this evil entity that no one can trust. And that's the old cliche. So that was almost when, that's when, particularly when the silent treatment went, I can't remember what they'd done. I think they'd done something. I think one of our tours went on sale and I told them, it was like, early on in the early days, I was like, this tour is going to sell really quickly and we're doing a pre-sale through the label and you have to be there. And they didn't bother even telling anyone. The guy that's meant to set it up at 9 o'clock hadn't turned up. The whole system crashed and blah, blah, blah. And I just didn't speak to them for 3 days and they all panicked massively. And then in the end, I think they paid us money for the amount of tickets that we would have sold that we couldn't have done or something. So bizarre. But I think it's just a case, but that comes hand in hand. Like I said, if you have that relationship where it is a partnership and you're talking to them every day, then they will notice. If you're just some bastard that shouts all the time anyway, they'll think it's actually a relief that you're not talking to them. So that's how it has to work. You have to be decent in the first place and have that line of communication. So all of a sudden, it's a bit weird when it's gone. Not like oh, thank God, we don't have to put up with him for 3 days because he's sulking. It has to be something that they might actually miss. They probably don't miss it anymore. But now it's been discussed twice in public. That's never going to work again. So I'm going to have to revert to the cliches and just start swearing at people.
Yeah. You might not be able to, but then you'll notice Eleanor and I and both of like our jobs will suddenly be like not applying to emails for like 3 days. I'm like, I hope you can think about this.
Yes. Take a good look at yourself. That's it. Come disappointed in you.
Stuart, I enjoyed reading, and I think this will be very kind of buoying for people listening to this who want to maybe be a manager themselves or work in the music industry, or maybe have been told that they can't accomplish what they dream of. You were told by a careers advisor at school that when you said you wanted to work in the music industry, they advised you could be a dustman.
I said be a dustman. I know. And I don't know how badly I was doing at school at the time, but I remember, I was like, I thought I was better than that. Even if they said I couldn't work in music, they were like, surely dustman's got to be something better. I mean,
there are several other things you could be to get to dustman.
I mean, they do get paid quite well, but I was just at the time going, why would you even think that was an alternative? You could have just said, go and work in a record shop or do anything that would ever start that. But no, it was very strange. And it's true. I was no real support. I was very sort of doggedly stubborn. I wanted to work in music. I wanted to be a roadie, was what I really wanted to be as a kid. And I was like, this is what I'm going to do. And I just sort of went ahead and sort of did stuff by myself and did it. But yeah, no real support. And it's almost people look at you incredulously when you sort of said it. And it's like, you know, still up to about 15 years ago, I'd have like aunts ask me if I was ever going to get a proper job and things like that. That still happens. Like, when are you going to get a real job? I think it's only when the label I was in was bought actually by Atlantic. I worked for Atlantic for a while. It was The Darkness. And that was the only real time that people actually noticed. And obviously then James Blunt came along. But with The Darkness, that was the first time people noticed that it was actually real. And, you know, my parents could actually talk to people at dinner parties and they'd have heard of a band I'd worked with. So I think that was when people started to pay attention. But I think, yeah, it's just the cases. Sorry if you can pick up my dog's barking, by the way. That's the thing. Just don't. If you believe in something, just go for it.
And so what was it like working on The Darkness? Because that must have been pretty crazy at the times.
Yes, to put it politely. It was immense fun. It was really pretty much only like a year and a half where we were just in the eye of the storm. And because we had signed them at Mushroom, and then we got bought out by Atlantic or Warner's. It was East West at the time. And so we went in there with The Darkness. We sort of arrived. There's like four of us had come from an indie label and we turned up with Bloody Darkness. No one really knew what was going on. And it just snowballed. And it was quite intense. Yeah, there was lots of craziness going along, trying to have meetings with people, band members turning up to meetings half cut they shouldn't even been at, all sorts of stuff in the record label that I couldn't ever possibly repeat. But it was immense fun, really good fun. And then we had them support us in Ipswich this summer just gone as well, because we were like, we were like, Edward, we need to have somebody from Suffolk support us, and we couldn't think of any bands. Get the fucking Darkness. So we did. It was great. So
come quite full circle.
Yeah, it was full circle.
What do you think? Because obviously Ed's got this funny reputation, doesn't he? Where he's kind of both like the lovable, like silly rogue, and then like the very, determined, ambitious person. But I guess with like the nice, more the nice guy kind of way of being, have you noticed yourself that there's been like more of a sanitization in the industry of like, all the sex, drugs and rock and roll has made way for like hardworking, diligent, nice boys and girls?
I don't think there's anyone really celebrating the sex, drugs and rock and roll element as much as certainly as they weren't when The Darkness were touring. But I think there's, yeah, but then sometimes it goes a bit far. You want something to be exciting. I'm not saying that, you know, it's all, you're right about it being slightly sanitised. And then obviously whenever there's a successful act, be it Amy Winehouse or Ed or even going back as far as Blunty and Adele, there's always several copycats that are the same. So you always have things that always look the same. So you have all these people that are trying to be nice and it doesn't really work, or trying the same shtick, it doesn't really happen. And that feels false in itself. And they're probably going home and getting absolutely off it and what have you. It's just not celebrated as much. But certainly I think the work ethic for most artists has gone up. Everyone knows they have to work. You can't, the two things aren't necessarily too compatible.
Ed has talked about, you know, for him, and I'm sure a lot of other celebrities and non-celebrities, drinking has been a way to calm his anxiety. And, you know, he's also had, as you say, he's clearly can't stop himself from looking at negative comments, and he's self-conscious, as anyone would be. How, we've talked about the guardianship element of your job earlier, but how much does it keep you up at night almost to think that this very vulnerable person who has got so many millions of eyeballs on them, like you, it's basically you are their almost like their little secret keeper?
Yeah, there's a few keepers now. I think now that he's much more settled now, he's married, and there's between me, the security, the tour manager, there's a little sort of inner circle that they are very, very protected, insanely protective of him. But he's certainly got a lot stronger out of it. He's still likes drinking, but but his he just drinks during the day and just sends you weird messages. That's the whole problem. Especially those in time.
You like, so do we.
I love you. Like, you've been drinking again. It's only 4 o'clock. But no, it's fine. It's but you're right. It's one of those sort of things when you do worry. I do take it very personally when people are rude to him. Well, I remember going to when we first did the Grammys. God, that must have been 2012. I won't name the artist, but Ed went up to say hello to an artist afterwards and they completely blanked him. Like, really rude. And Ed was so upset because they were a bit of a hero of his. And then a year later, that same artist emailed us going, hey, good to hang out once we've been a bit more successful. Great meeting you last year. Do you want to hop on my record? So it's times like that when Ed has to ring me quickly going, stop it. I know you're writing fuck off you C-U-N-T on an email. Because I will get really protective on things like that. But he'll actually be the one that steps in, and that's when he calms me down. Because I'm like, don't you fucking do that.
Oh, that's a nice energy together.
So we were talking a little bit as well about your, just to go back to how you started your career, and I know your personal taste as well is that you're a bit of like a heavy metal nut.
Yeah, right? Certainly not. Ed's horrified when he listens, play me some of the music you like, and he doesn't know what's going on. And he gets all introspective thinking that I just don't really care because I don't like music that has an acoustic guitar in it. But I do. it's not the same. But I think anyone can like any form of music. There's no barrier to it.
Would you like, if you weren't managing like the most successful pop act, male pop act in the world, and if it was nothing to do with you, would you personally choose to listen to Ed's music? Is it like...
I think so. I do genuinely like it. It's a strange question because I can't answer it because I have never not heard it without
context.
Or is that in your contract maybe?
I have to say that you would... If you're asked, never admit that you think I'm crap. No, it's not in my contract. No, but I think I would, genuinely. I do genuinely quite enjoy it. I've listened to nothing but Ed's music for the last 2 bloody months, and it hasn't sent me that mad. I do genuinely enjoy it. I do genuinely look forward to, if he's written a song, if he texts me saying, I've written a banger last night, it's like, great. You genuinely can't wait to hear it. And it's not just because, you know, I've got a leaky roof that needs fixing. It's because I just want to hear the music. Genuinely, really. But he never believes that. It's really sweet. He's like, you don't like me.
But maybe it's like, it could be a good thing anyway, right? In that you have like a healthy distance from the product.
Oh, completely.
So you can have more of an artistic...
Oh, completely. But I think it's also that I'm not operating in that world professionally. So I can enjoy something. Mm. I'll listen to Faith No More or something. And I'm never going to be putting Ed on a gig with them. It's never, those two lanes are never going to cross. So there's a bit of a distance as well for myself. So you get away from it. Whereas... if I suddenly said, oh, I go home and listen to, I don't know, who to compare him with, but you know, James Blunt or James Arthur or something, like, that's a bit weird. He must have listened to it too. So.
A bit obsessive. You got a little bit of distance between like the personal and the professional, at least.
Yes, because you hear so many people, I've got lots of friends who work in film and in games, and they say that they get so close to it, they don't actually enjoy the medium anymore because it's too much of them. When I first moved to London, I shared a room because we were so skint with my old one of my old flatmates at college, and he was a graphics editor on Teletubbies before it came out, and he never watched TV, so we all thought he was mad. He was like, no, I'm working, you must have seen this program, it's these giant babies and they're all like blah blah blah, like you're fucking insane, you're making up, because he was working on it a year before it came out, but he was so up there he didn't realize it hadn't come out. But I was working music, he was working TV. I'd come home, I just wanted to watch TV. He'd come home, he just wanted to listen to music. And it was just like, this isn't going to work because we needed that other space away from it.
You must get approached by bands or solo artists, male, female, all the time in terms of either advice to progress in the music industry or maybe straight up management requests. Would you ever consider taking on anyone else? And what advice would you give artists who are looking for a manager?
I don't myself. There's a few people in my office that sometimes that will pass stuff on, and we manage a few things, but not me directly. Purely back to my early things at the time. But I think for a manager, you just need to find someone that's got. It's not necessarily that you have to get someone who's got a reputation, who's already got lots of other clients, because someone like me who didn't have any of my own clients when I met Ed. So it's just, you have to have a connection with them. You have to know that there's going to be that honesty and that trust. And that you get on, and there shouldn't be, you'll know pretty early on, like you do with most people, if there's going to be some sort of weird barrier between you or some sort of weird mislevel of trust or respect, then it's not necessarily going to work. So you do have to click. some people, you know, it's not essential. You have to have a relationship or friends with them. You know, some people don't. It's just the way me and Ed worked out that we do, probably because we're so similar. But it's just purely, you kind of know if you can trust them, but you need to be careful about it. Spend a lot. Don't rush into anything. I mean, me and Ed didn't sign a contract for about 18 months when we first started, you know.
So in that 18 month, where are you kind of thinking, oh, maybe we could work together?
Yeah, definitely. But it was always a bit, you know, strange about making things official and what have you. And it was all going all over the place. And there was changes at the company I was working at. So it never really happened. And it was only when he paid for himself. He went to LA by himself. And then suddenly all these Americans like, I'm going to manage you. I'm like, excuse me. Fuck off. They'd email me.
You get a lot of people trying to poach you.
Oh yeah. Back in the first couple of years, it was a weekly bloody occurrence. You'd get an email from someone like, hey, I'm so and so, and I've decided I'm going to manage your client. I hate the word client. Anyway, I'm going
to
manage your client.
You're forwarding them all to you.
What the fucking hell are you talking about? And then people be like, oh, there's some weird bloke. I think he's got a gun and all this sort of stuff. You're like, Jesus, you know. So there was an element of that. The first couple of years, definitely. When he started breaking through, there was a lot of people circling around. But, you know.
So in the first 18 months, he was coming in and out of the Rocket offices occasionally, right? Because wasn't it as well, I read again a funny quote where someone had said, like, who's this very strange boy that keeps on
it might even have been Elton. But everyone was like, who is that scruffy tyke? Because, bless him, even if you look back at pictures now, there was a live at the Bedford, it was an EP we released just before we signed to Warner's. I didn't really, at the time you kind of forget what people look like. He literally had ginger hair. The spiky out here is like a really bad ginger Robert Smith at one point. It was all baggy trousers. Oh, it was just peculiar. And it's strange. I was having this conversation with someone the other day, how in those days, even with Adele and Sam Smith and then with Ed, people weren't expecting pop stars per se to look like that. And everyone's, it was all so much about the visual look. And it was like, these people don't look conform to the stereotype of what people should look like. So it was actually quite refreshing. But yeah, the initial reactions across the board with a lot of things, the first thing you hear was like, amazing voice, but what does he look like? And things like that. It was all so much. Now it's kind of, that paradigm has shifted in our favour, of course. But yeah, it was strange. No one knew, you quite knew who he was.
Did you ever consider persuading Ed to change up his look in those earlier years? Or did you always know, like, this is integral to, like, your brand?
I think it was. I think it was integral was the bit that he was different. And it was about the music, per se. And it's, you know, no one, yeah. It's we can laugh about it looking back at it. But, yeah, it was quite strange at the time that it was such an issue. But, no, I could never suggest that because that was the death knell of the previous management. So it's like, okay, Tim, don't tell him to dye his hair. So no, not really. It was, in hindsight, I'd love to go back and delete. There's a lot of photos of him with long hair and baseball caps, which I would really rather never see again. But no, it's just part of the experience and the journey. So you can't change anything.
You mentioned Elton John just now, and I love the fact that I think it's in the Rolling Stone article, which is a brilliant profile of Ed, how, you know, it was Elton that basically said to Ed, even I'm sick of you, fuck off. And that's what kind of triggered his...
A little bit, yeah. I think that Elton's I mean, he still is, even though we're not professionally tied anymore. He's brilliant and he's always there with the advice. And if you're feeling down, he'll send you a really abusive email just to cheer you up. And but he's always been there for us and he's always been really good. But he's quite sensible. I think he was definitely like, you need to go away for a year. Don't ever buy elasticated trousers. The two best bits of advice he gave us in one thing. Having a year off, stay away from elasticated trousers, but disappear.
Sound advice.
Yeah, it was sound advice. And Ed didn't. And it was all, it's all, the proof was there for everyone to see when we came back in 15.
Has Elton given you advice?
Oh yeah, loads. He's just always, him and David have always actually been quite kind to us. And even when we were separating or going our separate ways, it wasn't a case of, you know, you're leaving us and taking all the money. It was like, thank you for working with us all these years and all the best. And so it's been decent. It's been decent. He's a very, very funny man. Very funny man. It's always good to hear from Elton.
And he gives quite a lot of young artists advice.
Oh, he's obsessed.
He's
I don't know anyone who knows more about new music than him. When we could, he'd go out and buy pretty much every new release there was every Monday. He'd go out and buy it. And listen to it, and then he'd ring you up and talk to you about it. It'd be like, you talk to you about it. Have you heard that sound? I mean, it's rocking shit. I'm like, I don't even know who you're talking about, let alone heard the record. But he'd do it. He was obsessive. And if he likes someone, he'll ring you up and take you under their wing. It's like, remember the first time when he sort of first heard Ed, and he was like, I don't know where Ed was, but I was like, he had a phone in those days. I was like, Elton just rang me up saying, I'm going to ring him now. And I was going to Ed, pick up your fucking phone. It is Elton John. It's not a piss take. But he does it to a load of people. He'll just rings them up and barks at them for an hour, and it just changes their life. It's great.
So can you see, like, looking to the future, obviously you don't necessarily want to manage any other artists, like you say, but could you see yourselves, would you go into something that's maybe supporting or nurturing young talent, be it on the management side or the music side?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we've got this little label that we do through Atlantic Gingerbread, and that we want to expand that. But Ed, he'll come to a point where he just wants to be a songwriter or a producer rather than a touring artist or a pop star person.
He might start a family.
Yeah, exactly. There'll be a time, or to be fair, who knows, it may have been made for us, that there'll be a time when we can't go on tours for 3 years. So there will be a changing the dynamic, and I think that when then will be that will there will be a more of a support network, and he may, you know, it may be more of a partnership in management or the label side of things, about all about new artists, for sure. Definitely.
So you're not looking for like early retirement the minute?
No, I am. I'm constantly looking for early retirement. But every time I hit it, he goes, if you quit, I'll quit. And I'm like, well, I'm not doing that. So, yeah, I know. It's this whole pressure. So no, I don't think I'll ever escape, really. I think this is in for longer. But no real early retirement.
So what do you and Ed do when you want to kind of forget about the work and just hang out as, because it's clear you're friends and you get on as really good friends. Where would we find you on a Saturday night or afternoon?
It's afternoon. It's probably him drinking. We both share a love for really bad movies. So we're good at that. We've both got cinema rooms in our houses. So we'll tuck in there.
What was the last one you saw together?
What's the last one we saw together? This is bad, actually. When was the last film we saw together? God, I can't remember. I think the last thing you saw in my house together was the finale of Game of Thrones, when the air conditioning had broke. So we were sweating our tits off, and it was just horrible. And it was awful. It was really bad. And I just remember it being really hot, and Ed was so upset. He made us watch it. So that was the actual last thing in this house, but there will have been something.
And then he had the whole Game of Thrones lot over to his little bar.
Yes, I know. He's
You look so annoyed.
No, but that's the thing. There's an element of just people turning up very late at last minute. It's like, you know, Stormzy wants to come. You're like, okay, It's 2 o'clock in the morning. We closed 3 hours ago.
Oh, my God. Do you ever feel like you're taken advantage of, or rather maybe people are trying to get close to you for a specific reason? Do you ever feel like you have to be very wary in the same way that Ed does of your relationship?
No, 100%. Same with Ed as well. You definitely have a list, and you know who the dodgy ones are. And I have that list, and Ed knows what's on the list, and usually he'll come to me 2 years later and go, you were right, or hopefully you're wrong. But yeah, there's a lot of people that have an ulterior motive. He can never say no to anything at all.
Yeah.
So anyone will ask him to do anything, he'll do it. So I always have to say, don't just palm them off to me, or give them, you know, just hide behind me. And he has started saying now, apparently, I didn't know he did this, Stuart doesn't like it, it's not going to happen, people have left him alone. Well, it's only taken you 12 years to get to that point. But yeah, there's certainly, he's very good-natured, and he'll do a lot of things. I mean, obviously this year's a bit different, because we can just say we're doing nothing at all, and you just have to be, you know, uniform on that. But yeah, there is an element of that, for sure.
As you were saying, obviously you've travelled the world together, you've done so many huge tours, you've played the biggest shows all over the world, but what has been like a real highlight for you? Like, has there, across the years, whether that's a prize win, a moment where you've thought, it just can't get any better?
Oh, highlight. This is probably both of our highlights, because we're right sad little geeks. It's when we did The Hobbit and went to stay in New Zealand with Peter Jackson for 2 weeks. So that was all we ever wanted to do. That was on the second record, before the second record, actually. And it was like, oh, we can give up now, because that was just the ultimate sort of buzz at the time. So that was probably a highlight for one. We did a couple of things in Afghanistan as well. That was good. But yeah, probably The Hobbit and Peter Jackson was the sort of the memory that will stand out. But there's so many. If you know, I'll no doubt put this call down in a minute and think of another 10. But that's the one that really springs to mind.
How about like a specific like career moment? So when he's won like something specific or had it, broken a specific record, has there been something that meant more to you?
Well, that's the irony. The touring records, we broke the record on it's over 7 million people came to the last tour, and also we broke the money on income. And it actually took, the guys from the trade magazine in the US to ring us to tell us, because we hadn't even been tracking it. We didn't know or care. And it was like, what do you mean? And it was like, they were really freaked out. So we were giving all these interviews like, yeah, we're really not bothered. But so, but the biggest, probably the proudest would have been Glastonbury when we headlined, because we had no idea if anyone would come. We genuinely didn't, because it's not our ticket or, and it was like, it'd be fine. It's the Sunday night. Most people are in their cars by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So that we were kind of nervous. Then we'd been, you have to get there. We got a really dodgy helicopter ride there. My girlfriend threw up everywhere in the helicopter. So it was really fun getting there. And then, yeah, just get there and just waiting and waiting, waiting. And it was just, yeah, everyone else was, yeah, there was a pretty long, tense day. And just, yeah, that's the only time really I've seen him nervous before a show as well. So he went and did it. I mean, he played every song 3 times faster than it should normally be, but it was still an absolute triumph. So that was probably the best moment. So that after that, that sort of, that's probably the best party we've ever had as well. So that the Glastonbury post-show party was good.
What's his, because I've heard he throws some pretty cool, like that Rolling Stone piece, yeah. Just shows what his after parties are like. What is the
which
best?
Which one? I've not read that, I don't think. Which party did they reference? Or how?
Oh, well, he just has this, I think it's the writer's birthday and Ed Sheeran has him over to his house. And there's just a lot, I mean, it's just, there's a lot of access.
No, I do remember. Yeah, he was with us a lot, that guy. He has had some good parties. We had a brilliant, we did the MTV Awards in, God, where is it? It must have been Italy, I think. It's in Rome or Milan. And there was an official party that they'd forgotten to invite us to. So we're like, fucking hell, we're not going then. So Ed got in the right, not in a proper strop, but we just thought, for a laugh, we thought, let's just invite everybody to our room. And thinking no one would turn up.
Usurp the party.
Every bugger turned up, to the extent that the guys from the official party came up saying, we're really sorry that we didn't invite you. Can we join your party? And that was the big, that was the biggest triumph. That the official party.
That should be your career highlight.
Yeah, they gave up. They gave up and came up to us. Because anyone, it was like, there were so many people there. If you name a pop, U2 were there. Bieber was there. Well, it's just madness. Absolute madness. Kevin the security gave up trying to stop people coming in. So he went to sleep in a cupboard in the room. And we just carried on to about, we went on to about 6 o'clock in the morning. It was, yeah, that was probably the most legendary one. Yeah, but we try and have fun.
Were you there when Princess Beatrice sliced off a bit of his cheek?
No, I wasn't. But going back to when you get those phone calls when you're a bit dangerous or protective about him, I was the recipient of the other phone call of I've gone to casualty for that one. I've forgotten about that.
Oh, God.
No.
Oh, my God.
And we've not seen or heard hide nor hair from her since. We have her since.
Oh, really?
Because I got quite protective about that. Because we've never publicly commented on it, but certain people are like, oh, you should lie and say it wasn't her and someone else. I'm like, well, we're not telling anyone anything, but I'm not lying to cover.
Not saying much.
Yeah, I'm not lying because someone's a fucking idiot and they've been waving a sword around when you're all drunk. I mean, thank God it was only, I mean, it kind of suits him, that scar now.
Yeah, it's kind of a...
Jesus Christ, it's not safe. I know, we'll get paralytic and take a sword off the wall and wave it around our heads. Yeah,
literally, who has just a spare sword?
I know, that's it. That's the, when you hang out in those sort of circles, you're just asking for trouble, aren't you? It's I know, exactly.
Can you tell us about the moment where you and Ed, oh, I don't know if you were there, but when Ed fell asleep in a kind of snake-riddled field at Russell Crowe's house?
So he fell asleep? I was there. I probably can't tell you what happened.
Why was there a snake-riddled field in the
Because it was Australia. It's full of fucking snakes.
Yeah,
we'd gone to Russell's. Bless him. We'd never met him.
Russell Crowe's just... He's mad.
Have you met him?
No.
No, but from the stories I've read.
So we'd gone to... He'd sent a plane for us. And we'd gone to these... Because you've got this beautiful, like, 1,000-acre farm in, like, northeastern Australia. And we'd gone there and... He's got a pub in his garden, which is where Ed got the idea to build his pub. And
oh, really?
Yeah. So he's got a pub in the garden, and he'd invite like the local soccer team, like the local girls' soccer team, some other random actor. And there's like me, Kevin, and Ed, and everyone just getting really, really drunk. And then I think towards the end, I can't remember. We discovered that he had a full-sized arcade underneath this pub. So I think me and Kevin, being the age of it, got a bit too nostalgic playing like some old arcade game. Ed had just wandered off across this bloody field that we were told not to walk in. So there's like people chasing him on bikes and stuff, trying to find him. He's like, you're going to die. But he didn't. But yeah, That's the short story version of that story.
But, do you know what kind of snake?
I have no idea what sort of snakes. Australia is an absolutely terrifying.
Best not to know, probably.
Yeah, yeah. But they were like, you really shouldn't do that. But Ed just, you know, everyone has sort of that drunk homing pigeon type thing. You know, when you know it's time, it's enough. You know, something bad's going to happen if I stay here. So off he went. But he just probably thinks he was being smart. Straightest line towards the cabin where we're staying. But yeah, it wasn't.
I love how Kevin's in basically all of these stories. I want to know more about Kevin. Are him and Ed like best friends?
You should look at Security Kev. It's an Instagram account. Security Kev.
I see.
Security, I think it's just at Security Kev. Let's just say it's not Kevin that writes the captions or chooses the pictures. So make of that what you will, but it's all about him and Ed. But have a
look. So it's like a fan account.
It's a bit of a fan account written by the artist himself, pretending to be someone else. But yeah.
Love that.
But it's definitely worth looking at, for sure.
What's on your guys' rider these days? Do you have a very specific list that you stick to?
Yeah, but it's not. It's just lots of food we don't eat. So we keep trying to change it. And then wherever you go, it keeps going back. Everyone keeps going back to the old rider. It's a load of old crap. But no, it's quite good. So you always used to be tuna and cucumber sandwiches and cans of Stella. Ooh. That's all it was for years.
Nice.
I know.
Can't go wrong with a tuna sandwich. You just can't.
I love a tuna sandwich.
No. Ed's mum never let him have cucumber as a kid. For some reason, I cannot remember why.
What?
That's I know, it's really strange, isn't it? So he's obsessed with cucumbers. So any opportunity to have a cucumber, he's in there. It's
brilliant.
Yeah, I don't know if someone's allergic to them in the family, but there was definitely there was some cucumber withdrawal as a child that scarred him into adult life. Yeah,
I think that's the most enlightening thing you've said about it.
So do you think with, I guess, obviously everything's so up in the air right now that we can't really predict what on earth the music industry is going to look like in a year's time, but have you thought anyway, Ed will come back with the album, are you just going to approach it music first and let everything else come after?
No, precisely. That's it. I mean, like, we've started recording now, like I said, but we don't, who knows, we'll probably really put a record out this time next year, if all being well, but yeah, we don't know whether we're going to tour it or when. So we've got a year to sort of get ourselves in order and then see where the world is at the moment, really. But yeah, we'll be different, because obviously it's not even just playing shows. It's like we go to every corner of the world promoting records as well. So if we can't do that, it's a big change for us as well.
And lastly, what kind of, I'll ask you questions and then we catch you for an age, sorry, but what advice would you give to a kind of up-and-coming artist, like beyond just having Ed's work ethic, which is insane? What are some of the kind of more specific things that you've noticed have really worked for Ed?
I think it's not so much work ethic, it's just about being true to yourself. I don't think you shouldn't ever impersonate anybody. If you want to be successful, and even if you admire someone, don't impersonate them or be a copy of them. Just be yourself and do music that moves you. And then if it moves you, people will believe in it, and then you'll believe in it, and you'll get better at it. That's a real key thing. You see some artists that try and change themselves to be successful, and you know, maybe that works for some people, but I don't think it does in the long term. You've got to be true to yourself. So it's purely do what you want, and if it's good enough, people will come to you. They really will. So that's definitely works for me. And it's just, like I said, every other business decision, just be decent to people.